Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, the sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
I'm totally paying attention, guys.
All right, so we're here. We're sitting around the microphones. I expect that means we're going to talk about something.
Space tourism, again.
I was about to say, we literally just talked about space tourism.
Yeah, but we didn't talk enough about money, the really exciting part of space.
Oh, right. Joe had mentioned that he was upset that he wasn't able to afford it.
Yeah, all of the cool things I want to do are way too expensive.
Well, Joe, come on, give me a rundown. What are we talking about with too expensive?
Well, just a few examples. There were companies offering suborbital spaceflight, and as a reminder, that's where you sort of you go up in a spacecraft, it's a pressurized vehicle, and you technically enter space,
right,
but you don't orbit the Earth.
Yeah, it's just a 90-minute jaunt.
Yeah, you stay up there briefly, you experience a little bit of weightlessness, you see the curvature of the Earth and the stars, and that sounds really cool, but Virgin Galactic is citing that that's going to cost you $250,000 per person.
Once it's active. It's not even going yet.
That's just the proposal.
Yeah.
So there is orbital space tourism. Mm-hmm. So that's where you would go up and in a vehicle, say, join with a space station like the International Space Station, or maybe a little bit further in the future with some kind of private space station.
Mm-hmm.
And you would orbit the Earth there. Trips like that so far have cost in the range of $20 to $50 million.
Ooh, yeah, that's pretty expensive.
Yeah. If you want to go to the moon...
I totally want to go to the moon.
Oh, it sounds great, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's going to cost you $750 million, or if you want to take your wife with you or somebody else, I don't know, it's going to be $1.5 billion for the two of you.
I have so many jokes I want to make right now, but I also want to remain married, so I'm going to not joke about going to the moon without my wife.
Let's be so sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it'd be a romantic vacation.
I mean, gray romantic adventure.
You could
together.
Have another honeymoon.
Congratulations, sir. Have crossed the line.
Met with the quiet, disinterested space.
In space, no one can hear your scowling disapproval.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, so yeah, these are all really expensive.
So expensive. Yeah. There is no way anybody, I don't know about y'all's personal financials, there's no way I could ever afford to do this.
And in fact, I remember reading an interview, or actually it was more of a report that someone wrote about Richard Garriott, who was the one member of the space tourists. They hate that term, but the people, the private citizens who have paid to go
private
up into space, private
mm-hmm.
astronauts. He's one that is considered to be kind of an evangelist for space exploration among private citizens. And, also the only one that I've ever personally met. But he was saying that he felt that his work was going very far into the democratization of space travel. And the person who wrote the article critiqued that a little bit by saying, well, at $30 million to go up, that's not really democratization. You're talking, you know, yes, you've opened it up in that private citizens have gone up there, but it's such a small number who can afford to that it's not really democratization.
Well, so we should ask the question, are these prices ever going to come down? And if so, how? Well, how can we make it cheaper for the average person to go to space?
We need to know, why is it so expensive to start with?
Well, that's a good point.
That's the first, you know, in order for us to know, can it be cheaper, we have to know, why is it so expensive?
Yeah, so one of the things is rockets, right?
Yeah, they're not cheap.
They're not cheap. The American Space Shuttle Endeavour cost some $1.7 billion to build. And NASA said that each launch of it costs some $450 million.
And I got to tell you guys, the ice maker on the Endeavor totally does not work.
Ugh.
Yeah. It's just, I can't believe it.
You're in space. Can't you just stick water out the window?
You can. I don't recommend sticking your whole arm outside the window. But
And the thing is that $450 million expenditure is relatively low, really, when you consider the lifetime cost of the entire program, of the shuttle program overall. It's been estimated at $192 billion in 2010 dollars.
Yeah, billion with a B.
Yeah, yeah. And that would put the average cost per launch from 1982 through 2010 at some $1.5 billion.
Yeah. Now, if you're talking about just launching a vehicle costs that much, that would go a long way to explaining why a ticket aboard any of these experiences would cost, that huge amount of money. If you're talking about paying a government agency, so for example, the private astronauts we talked about in the last episode, they were all going through Space Adventures, which was coordinating with the Russian Space Agency, right? Well, the Russian Space Agency is a governmental agency that was looking to offset maintenance costs. And so this for them was a way of offsetting that expense. Space Adventures obviously took some sort of cut. We have no idea how much of a cut they took, but they took a cut as coordinating this whole thing between the astronaut and the Russian Space Agency. But if you're talking about a private company that is making its main business as taking people from Earth into space, they have to be able to offset all costs and make a profit. Right? That's assuming that they're operating a business the way we traditionally want a business to run, which is that you are generating enough revenue to offset all your costs so that you're making a profit at the end of the day. Well, if you're talking about something that's this expensive, that explains why those tickets have to be so high.
Well, and people have given a lot of flack to NASA about the amount that they've spent on their shuttle program. Numbers aren't really available for the Russian space shuttle program.
Right. No, the Russians are not terribly communicative when it comes to that kind of thing.
Yeah, but they've been rumored to cost as little as $45 to $80 million per launch.
That's, significantly less money.
Yeah. And, so, and you know, like SpaceX can send the Falcon 9. It advertises being able to send the Falcon up for $60 million, or under $60 million even.
Mm-hmm. For the record, SpaceX is one of the private space companies.
Right.
That's the one that Elon Musk founded.
Right. Yeah. Although those are unmanned, and they are still in testing phases for the manned Dragon capsules. Mm-hmm. They're supposedly going to be doing some safety tests as early as Q2 in 2014. So that's pretty exciting. But those would still be unmanned because they're still not entirely sure. The reason that they want to do some safety tests is to make sure that if things start exploding, that they can kind of throw the people to safety.
Sure.
So
yeah.
This is in an early stage in
right.
all of this.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense. Yeah, as it turns out, rockets specifically are incredibly expensive. They're expensive to build. They're expensive to fuel. They're expensive to operate. When you listen to our last podcast, when we were talking about the suborbital flights and they were much lower in price, part of that is because you're talking about a lot of aircraft that are launched from other aircraft, right?
Yeah, they're not the piggyback game.
Yeah, exactly. They're not launching by a rocket from the surface of the Earth and then have to reach escape velocity and then get out of Earth that way. So one of the big expenses is not really a concern there. You know, you don't have to worry about the rocket stuff. So, yeah, I mean, as it turns out, getting into space, pretty pricey, right?
But this is a problem that people are working on. I mean, it's to everyone's advantage to bring these costs down.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everything from being able to do research and development to other types of scientific endeavors. Obviously, if you're able to lower that financial barrier, then you can do a lot more stuff.
Right. You can start actually funding the projects.
Instead of just getting them up there.
Okay. So some of these high costs involved. I mean, you know, first of all, the startup costs are just absolutely crazy.
Yeah,
I mean,
you have to astronomical.
Oh dear. You have to worry about regulations. I mean, first we have to build a regulation industry for this sort of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, startup, that's a problem for any new technology, right?
You talk about putting people into space, it's more than doubly so, but yes.
Well, there you have to do extensive testing and stuff because you're dealing with human safety.
Right.
But with any new technology, there's going to be a problem with not many other people are doing this yet, so you don't have like a lot of standardized parts you can use and stuff like that.
Well, sure. I mean, like Elon Musk, when he was working on SpaceX, talked about how when they were first looking at getting rockets from the Russian space agency, that they'd be quoted a price for something like, you know, five rockets will be $20 million, and they would agree upon that price, and then they would go to Russia and they would say, oh no, I'm sorry, it's $20 million per rocket. And suddenly your price has quintupled, right? You've now had to pay $100 million to get those five rockets. And he said that the problem is that there weren't a lot of other places you could go. It's not like you had any alternatives. You had a very few number of players in this game, so that was part of the problem. Although he's definitely invested in SpaceX to try and work around that now.
Oh, right. Sure. And that's one of the big things that people are talking about, getting, you know, allowing for multiple launch providers and vehicles, so that you can cut down on launch failure costs, for example. Mm-hmm. About 90, only about 90% of launches are successful. The other 10% having to, be taken down for a few days in order to, you know, figure out what went wrong get it back up there, get it up safely.
Yeah, so when we're saying that there's a 10% failure rate, we're not talking catastrophic failure.
Right, certainly not. You're not looking at the Challenger happening 10% of the time.
Right.
Of course, then again, a catastrophic failure on a rocket is much worse than a catastrophic failure on a toaster.
Yes.
Absolutely. And that is one of those things that one of the reasons why testing is so expensive for this kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, also when you're dealing with equipment that has cost you a few hundred million dollars to put together and it does go wrong in testing, that's a bigger setback than, again, a toaster. But once you get multiple manufacturers working in this field and, some industry standards for mm-hmm. how to build these parts, you know, you're not going to have the example of a single company creating all the parts for something. Like with NASA back in the day, one of those big famous reasons why stuff got so expensive for NASA so quickly was that these companies that were making parts for them had basically gone out of business in all other sectors. They were only making parts for the space program, and no one else had the technology to make them.
Right, so they can determine what the price is, and NASA would have to pay it because there wasn't an alternative.
And furthermore, their costs of creating this stuff were way higher than they otherwise would have been because they weren't doing anything else to make income happen.
Mm. Yeah.
But yep. You know, there was that one time that I think NASA had to buy some stuff on eBay because they ran out of parts and no one was making them anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not the most useful.
They also got a lovely little Yoda cookie dispenser.
True fact. What they needed was like an out of print Grateful Dead bootleg LP from the 1970s.
There's a lot of blacklight posters to go aboard the ISS. We are very quickly disassembling this serious podcast.
Anyway, but there are other problems with rocket launch include the fact that you've got a lot of material and part waste in it, right?
Oh,
You don't have enough reusable parts and materials. Like, there's this idea of the single stage to orbit rocket. You've heard of this, right?
Yeah.
That it's a single vehicle that can launch itself into space without having to just basically throw the rocket away and let it fall into the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you could get some reusable tanks for stuff like that, then that would...
Or even cost.
Better recycling yeah. processes would be much better.
But as far as I'm aware, no technology like this has been even close to realized.
No, they're thinking really hard about it, but right now it's all right in those early dangerous testing stages. Mm-hmm. Also just infrastructure.
Sure.
We would need to add a lot to either, I mean, to make it really cheap, if you could add something to existing airports or space ports, I guess, space centers, then that would help out a lot. But,
right.
You know, we don't have the capacity to send tourist flights up at the current moment.
One of the ones I like to talk about is Spaceport America, which is in New Mexico. Real thing, y'all. I'm not joking.
I've not heard of this.
Yeah, Spaceport America. Yeah. Totally. It's a thing. So that would be a rare example. You guys are looking at me like I'm crazy. It really is.
I've never heard of this. It sounds like a theme park.
No, you've never.
We're usually looking at you like you're crazy.
Okay,
Jonathan.
No, but it's really a spaceport that's been built for commercial space endeavors. So it's, you know, look it up. I've got it on my screen.
I believe
right
you.
So anyway, That's a rare example of someone getting together, raising the money, and building out something from the ground up that is not an additive facility on something that pre-exists, right? So, like you're saying, that's the exception, not the rule, because to do that costs even more money, right? To just build the place where the spacecraft are going to take off and land.
So people are working on solutions to these problems. And Joe, I think that you had some numbers on how that's going.
Yeah, I'm going to quote from the abstract of a paper by Powell, Mays, and Rather that I'm going to refer to in a minute here. But what they say is, quote, despite decades of efforts to reduce rocket launch costs, improvements are marginal. Launch cost for LEO for cargo is about $10,000 per kilogram of payload, and to higher orbit and beyond, much greater. And human access to the ISS still costs about $20 million for a single passenger.
So that sounds like absolutely no progress at all. Or maybe marginal progress, depending on inflation rates.
Right. If you take inflation into account, we have made progress, but it is hard to illustrate because the actual amounts have remained
the same.
It's
like that 1% raise that you get that is almost more.
Yeah, it's supposed to be that whole cost of living raise.
Yeah.
All
right, so this is depressing. What other alternatives might we have to this whole really costly rocket business?
Well, you might have seen that video of a frog that had been on the side of the rocket and tried to hitch a ride up. I don't recommend that.
That is still, I feel that really bad for that frog, and it is still one of my favorite photos of 2013. It was just so,
silhouetted
just this perfect
in the air.
Silhouette of a frog.
It's also still rocket.
Yeah.
Still rockets.
But if you're hitching a ride, that's
free.
That's what hitching means.
There's no such thing as a free rocket. Okay.
Okay, so we got
to
talk about alternatives.
Yeah, non-rocket space launch. How do you get into space without a rocket?
Well, being there already is great.
Okay.
Cool.
But
be born in space.
Be born in space.
On the surface of the Earth.
Right.
And
how do you get from Earth to space?
In fact, not just to space, but to orbit. Because that's what really matters.
So right now, we don't really have a way of doing that, but we have several ways that kind of border between science fiction and science fact. Like the principles we understand and we think, you know, on paper we can get them to work. Whether we can ever make them practical is a matter of engineering.
Yeah, so we've got hundreds of really interesting ideas on how to do this, but none are proven.
So space elevator, obviously one of our favorites.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before on the show.
Right. Yeah. The idea is that you've got essentially a line that is anchored at two points. One is on the surface of the Earth, somewhere on the equator. And another one is on an anchor that's in orbit around the Earth. So you've got this tether that connects the anchor point that's around orbit to the Earth, to the Earth's surface. And then you have an elevator, a device that can climb said tether, from the surface of the Earth all the way out to the anchor point out in space, where you would then be able to launch, off into wherever you needed to go at a much lower, cost of energy, because you don't have to escape the Earth's gravity. You don't have to have that escape velocity because the elevator has done all that work for you.
Yeah, in contrast to the figures we cited a minute ago, the numbers that usually float around are that people estimate the space elevator would cost about $100 to $400 per pound.
Yeah,
but
significantly
that's a total
less.
Estimate. We don't really know
because there's nothing that
we haven't built
yet.
And we don't know how expensive it would be to build. So when you take into that lifetime cost.
Or if it's even possible.
Right, because we don't know that we can find anything that will have the tensile strength necessary to be able to provide that tether.
Mm-hmm. And of course, people really like saying things about carbon nanotubes. So,
well, carbon nanotubes may not even have the tensile strength. Mm-hmm. They are stronger than diamond, but they may not have the tensile strength necessary to be a viable cable. There are some other possible alternatives that are even stronger than carbon nanotubes, but all of those are materials that are so experimental that we're able to produce
unobtainium right now.
Yeah, you're able to produce like a one atom thick strand of it, which obviously would not work for something like an elevator tether.
Okay. Oh, are there any kooky non-rocket launch ideas out there that don't involve exotic materials of some
kind?
Sure.
Let me talk about a launch loop.
A launch loop?
Yeah, this is one that I had to read. I had to read for about an hour.
It sounds so crazy.
It's pretty crazy. So, all right. So a launch loop, imagine that you've got a really long, they call it a sheath. Think of it as a tube. It's an enclosed tube, in which you are able to create a vacuum. So
it's a hyperloop to space.
Hyperloop to space is, it's not totally wrong, but it's a little, it's a little different. You don't have little air bearings to go on. So yeah, but think of a tube. So you got a tube that's got a vacuum inside of it. And also inside this tube is a second tube. This tube is made out of iron. It's called a rotor. And it's you use magnets so that it ends up being suspended within the first tube, right? Because iron's a ferrous material, so you can do that. So you create this system where the iron is essentially floating within the confines of this sheath. Then you use electromagnets, linear motors, essentially, to start spinning that iron rotor within the sheath. Once it starts spinning, that's going to create angular momentum, which will actually cause the sheath to rise up into the air if you start spinning it fast enough. We're talking super fast, so fast that for a 4,000 kilometer length sheath in one loop, the iron would make a full revolution in 6 minutes for 4,000 kilometers. That's really fast.
Yeah.
So you're going super fast at that speed. It rises up. It's anchored at on the Earth at two points. Some cables actually are also anchoring it so it doesn't fly into the wrong shape. It eventually, at around 80 kilometers, ends up becoming more or less parallel to the ground. It also has to be somewhere close to the equator, probably on the ocean somewhere. You would have two stations that would be elevated, the east station and the west station. You would travel from the west to the east. So the way this would work is first you would catch essentially what would amount to be an elevator that would climb the cable up till you got to the west station. For the west station, you would then board a capsule, which would then be propelled across the length of the cable that's like 2,000 kilometers long at this point toward the east station. Along the way, you would reach orbital velocity and be released out into space, where then you would use whatever your capsule's propulsion mechanism is to orient yourself properly and then go on your merry little way. This sounds crazy to me, because the amount of energy you would need to move that much iron, essentially 4,000 kilometers of iron, that fast would be equivalent to what you would see in a nuclear explosion. You would be using these really super powerful linear motors to achieve that, but I can't imagine where you get all that power, and if something bad happens, I can't imagine what the fallout would be. Now, granted, it would not be a nuclear explosion. There's no nuclear reaction going on with this.
Sure.
It's purely physical. Also, you would have to worry about heat. If any leak happened along that sheath, and air got in, those little bitty air molecules, which would seem to be harmless to anybody, are going to interact with that rotor moving at incredible speeds, generate tons of heat, and then you have a catastrophic failure.
Yeah, this all sounds like obviously you would be using a lot less fuel from that capsule, you know, from this great height into orbit itself. But the energy expenditure, you wouldn't really be saving anything, I don't think, from.
Yeah,
that's debatable.
It supposedly takes less energy to operate it. You would have to operate continuously. I can't imagine how you would turn it off.
If you turned it off, that seems like it would collapse.
Yeah,
wouldn't it?
It would start. They're supposed to be the designs also involve parachutes, so that if the thing does turn off, that it would parachute down. Because otherwise, you're talking about, you know, 4 kilometers of iron falling to the Earth's surface,
or to the ocean surface,
or possibly if it breaks off, could go into orbit. But it's not, and the whole thing, by the way, your capsule and everything, it connects to this cable, electromagnetically.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's got little hooks. Like the first time I read it, I imagined one of those, if you've ever played with one of those really old race car tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Where the car went onto a hook, like the car there was nothing special about the car. It would just hook onto a little hook and the hook would travel the length of the track.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I imagined at first, but no, it's electromagnetic. It's not actually a physical connection. but the more I read about this, and I don't pretend to understand everything about this. I'm not an engineer, and a lot of the stuff I read was, I mean, all of this is really hypothetical or, you know, at best theoretical. I have a real hard time believing that this would be something that could be achievable. I think just getting it to the right elevation would be really challenging, because you're talking about something that's mounted on platforms out in the ocean, and you would have to start it off at a very gradual speed and then build up speed to have this thing elevate to the right height based upon that angular momentum. I have a real hard time imagining all of that. I mean, it could very well be in the realm of possibility. It's just beyond my understanding.
It does. It's something about the picture of it in your brain seems so violent, you know, just the movement of that much mass around in the loop. It seems crazy for that reason.
Sure. Yeah.
But then again, I'm no engineer. I couldn't really judge, but it does seem pretty wacky.
Yeah. So let's talk about something else. Let's talk about something that is, you know, perfectly feasible, like shooting people into space with magnets.
There are all different kinds of ways to shoot people into space.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is this concept of something that's like basically a space gun. It's just like a cannon that you could shoot something to try to achieve orbital velocity.
It's like a French film that covered
like
this.
Evil Knievel?
Yeah, like, the problem is, of course, that creates way too many G-forces and would kill you
if you... Your skull would liquefy just like an Event Horizon, Lauren. You remember that movie?
I do remember that movie.
And so there are other ideas that are like, well, what if we could do a similar concept? So the goal is to throw you into space.
Right.
So we're talking like a trebuchet.
Yeah. To get
actually, we're
you
talking
going,
about a Bob's Big Boy with an arm that's cocked back.
To get you going so fast that you just by your own momentum escape Earth's gravity and achieve orbital velocity.
Yeah.
So, wow, that seems like that would require a lot of speed, and it does, but if they slowly work you up to that speed, you could do it.
Well, right? And again, they're talking, in this case, you're talking about a maglev approach, right?
Yeah, yeah. I want to cite one specific example of the general mass driver kind of approach. And this is the Star Tram.
So again, we're talking about a system where you have a vacuum or near vacuum tube. So
yeah.
You've cut down on air resistance. Well, so that's no longer a factor.
No, I can explain it here. It's,
sure.
I'm citing from the paper, maglev launch, ultra low cost, ultra high volume access to space for cargo and humans. And that's the paper I referred to earlier by Powell, Mays, and Rather. And so basically the proposed StarTram system is like an orbital launch version of a maglev train.
Mm-hmm.
So a magnetized capsule containing cargo or passengers is accelerated by electrically powered magnetic propulsion through a ground level tube that's been pumped free of atmosphere. And so you think about it like basically a giant vacuum pipe. So it is kind of like
the Hyperloop.
Yeah, we referred to the Hyperloop earlier.
Yeah, Hyperloop is low pressure, but this would be total vacuum, or
exactly,
as close to it as we could possibly get.
Right, it'd be near vacuum. And so superconducting magnets on the vehicle push outward, and they keep the vehicle from touching the inner walls of this giant tunnel.
So you're not losing speed due to friction.
Right. It levitates magnetically just like a maglev train. It's mm-hmm. floating in the air. And so that helps it achieve virtually unlimited speed. There's no friction of
right,
any kind.
Right, to hold it back, sure.
And meanwhile, the tunnel sends pulses of current through aluminum rings along the length of the tube, and this pushes the magnets on the vehicle to accelerate it. So like I said, there's basically no limit to the speed as long as it remains in a vacuum or near vacuum. And eventually the spacecraft attains speeds greater than 8 kilometers per second, or about
Ooh.
5 miles per second, and is blasted out the end of the tunnel like a bullet. And with the help of a very modest rocket burst, it makes its way to low Earth orbit.
Yeah, it also, by the way, if you happen to be anywhere near that side, you're going to
you don't want to be anywhere near it.
Yeah, because you're going to get some sonic booms.
No, they say that this thing should come out in an unoccupied area.
Yeah.
And so what they propose is a two-stage system. So the first implementation is Generation 1. And that's easier, but it's only okay for cargo. And Generation 2 would experience less G-force trauma, so it would be okay for humans. And the way Generation 1 works is that it can just accelerate along the ground and then run up the side of a tall mountain, and that's all they have to do. And the authors think that this is doable by 2020 with ideal funding, but that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, that would be ideal.
Generation 2 cannot go up the side of the mountain. Why? Well, what happens when you come out of the tube, from the vacuum tube to suddenly a place where there's air?
You hit air, which immediately means that you hit resistance.
Yeah,
so you're going to decelerate and you're going to heat up.
Yeah, you're going to slow down and heat up really fast. That's fine for cargo, but if you've got people in the capsule, the G-forces of doing that could kill them. So what it needs to do is it needs to be magnetically levitated up higher, higher, and higher until the end of that tube is about 20 kilometers or 12.4 miles up off the surface of the Earth.
Wow. This blows my mind.
Yeah. So what basically what they say is that the 20-kilometer exit is doable through magnetic levitation. So you've got dual maglev here. The capsule is suspended in the tube by magnets, but then the tube itself is suspended by magnets over the surface of the Earth. And this is a dual system, so it's got superconducting magnets pointing in both directions from the bottom of the tube and from the track along the ground.
Sure. Now, this is where I have a real hard time imagining this, because I'm trying to imagine the end of a tube that's suspended 20 kilometers above the surface of the Earth that has magnets powerful enough both in the tube and along the ground beneath so that the tube remains
upright, levitated.
Because, you know, I don't know what angle they're talking about here. Like, I don't know what distances we're talking about, right? I would imagine it's probably a fairly aggressive angle because, you know, I don't know why you would have a gradual angle to get out of the Earth's orbit. That would mean that your track would have to be incredibly long. So I imagine that it's probably a fairly aggressive angle, kind of similar to, and not necessarily like straight back like you would be if you were on a rocket.
Oh, no.
But
no, it's much more gradual than that.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's an angle. Well, I mean, so I have some illustrations here, but I don't.
Yeah, I don't know if the illustrations are accurate. It just makes me think.
It's certainly not vertical.
Because if you're talking about going out so that you're 20 kilometers high, keep in mind the that side of your right triangle is going to be the longest side, right? That's the distance down and the distance straight back to the point of origin are going to be shorter than that angle you're at. You're essentially at the hypotenuse. It's hard for me to imagine how powerful those magnets would have to be to keep it suspended. I'm sure it's possible. It's just one of those where I'm thinking, like, man, don't wear any ferrous material when you
take
go
the coins out of your pocket.
Yeah.
They address this in the paper. So they say that it's going to be lifted up by the magnets and it has to be held in place for stabilization by tethers to the ground.
Sure.
And so what they say is that the launch tube has high current superconducting cables that magnetically interact with the second set of high current SC cables on the surface beneath. And that creates a levitation force it's several metric tons per meter of tube length. That's a quote from their paper. And what they say is that levitation force is greater than the weight of the launch tube.
I understand that. I just don't understand where they're getting the energy to do that.
When you start putting it this way, I'm starting to think that this whole space elevator thing has a lot of promise.
because the superconducting also, that the problem with superconductors in general is that most of them have to be supercooled to work, right? You can't just, there are very few superconductors that work at quote unquote warm temperatures. And by warm, I'm talking about hundreds of degrees below freezing, but still.
But not at absolute zero.
Yeah, not at absolute zero.
I mean, people are working on that technology as well, but right now it's happening in, you know, like the nano to micro kind of scape.
Right.
So.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I'm sure it's a possibility. Again, it's one of those things, like the launch loop, it's very hard for me to envision based upon my admittedly limited understanding of superconductors and magnetism.
Yeah. So even if we believe they can do what they say they can do, the authors of this paper themselves suggest that the Generation 2 one, the one that'll provide human passengers,
sure,
so that's the one relevant to space tourism, mm-hmm, will cost $67 billion. But put that in contrast with something that they also cite, which is that the launch volume of this would make it worth it because it could pump out 300 tons of cargo and 400,000 passengers a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that
make it up in volume.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for that kind of system, that's not a very expensive cost at all. So I, you know,
yeah, I mean,
looking at the relative,
than the shuttle program. Sure. Yeah. So again, one of those things that if they can get the engineering to work out, then that would be amazing. I mean, I think this would be truly an awesome sight to behold. Just the levitating track that extends 20 kilometers into the sky alone would blow my mind.
Yeah. For the record, like Mount Everest is about 8 kilometers up. So if that gives you any kind of earthly idea.
Yeah. So all of these non-rocket space launch ideas, they sound really cool, but at the same time sound like, how is that possible? Over and over again, when you look at these, it's like, that's really interesting. it seems so implausible. I don't want to say they can't do it, because right. I think they should go for it. I mean, I am all for people researching methods like these. But for now, maybe we should turn back and try to focus on, okay, let's say these ideas like the space elevator, launch loop, maglev.
Let's say they're 20 to 30 years away.
Let's say they're not. Let's say that they are actually as implausible as they sound.
Okay.
What are some ways that we could practically reduce the cost of space tourism if we're stuck with basically still pretty expensive launch costs?
Okay, so what you're saying is the cost of getting someone up into space has remained the same. So we haven't yeah. magically found some way to make rockets super cheap.
But, is there right. a way? Sorry.
Oh, no, no, no. Well, just, you know, yeah, how can we make it cheaper for the average
traveler?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so, yeah, let's hear some ideas. Okay, so if we can't affect the cost that's going to be incurred at the base level, then how can we make the ticket price lower? Joe, you seem to have an idea.
Well, it's not my idea, but how about a lottery?
Are you right now?
I'm bad at math. I like lotteries.
No, Lauren, you did not participate in the last office lottery.
You are so correct.
And they bought the ticket two blocks away. So it was one of those moments where, like, the winning ticket was bought near my office.
I'm talking about a lottery that's better than one for money. This is a lottery to go to space.
Okay, that is a much cooler lottery.
That is true. Yeah,
Buzz Aldrin has voiced support for this idea. I want to give a quote that he gave to Popular Mechanics in 2008. He said, "I want to increase the opportunity for more people to share in going to orbit. I think I can establish a controlled, legal, highly productive, random selection of small investments by people and a selection process that works like a lottery. The experience that you can win is non-transferable. That means you put a name down, you buy a ticket, and that person has to use it or lose it."
So you can't scalp your ticket to
exactly,
orbit.
Exactly.
That's
right.
Really good. Thank you. Thank you, Buzz, for putting that clause in there.
Yeah. So I think that idea makes a lot of sense to me. So you could have, well, there will obviously still be rich people who can afford to pay the cost to get a guaranteed ticket to space, but there will also be plenty of tickets that you can put up for lottery. So you could buy a $10 space lottery ticket.
Unfortunately, there's a $19.9 million convenience fee. I'm just thinking that Buzz Aldrin would work like Ticketmaster.
Nice.
No. But that's a great idea. This idea of, sure, you know you're buying a chance, and that chance may be determined by how many other people are participating in that particular lottery, right?
Sure. And in the same way that many state money related lotteries go to fund the state education system or mm-hmm. something like that, the money that you'd be putting in would be going to awesome stuff. I mean, space research and sending one of your fellow human people up for that kind of experience. That's pretty cool.
Exactly. And I think one thing that's cool about this is, so obviously it will still mean that most people who buy a ticket won't get to go. But what it will mean is that not everybody who goes is going to be somebody who's filthy rich.
Right.
I'm going to go ahead and call dibs here. I volunteer as tribute. We're talking lotteries here. So I just wanted to get my word in there before all the tickets are sold.
Nice.
Thank you. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of an interesting idea. Again, we're obviously you're talking about how this does not truly offset the cost of getting someone into space directly. But again, if you have a lottery that's successful enough, then just through the sheer number of tickets you've sold, you've managed to offset that. That's a fantastic idea.
I very much support that idea. And I want to talk about another one.
Okay.
This is one that I mentioned in the video episode I wrote mm-hmm. about this. How about doing research?
Yeah, every single person, as far as I can tell, every single person who has gone to the ISS as their private astronauts has done some kind of scientific research while up there.
But if you take it a little bit further, if you really do volunteer as tribute to go up for scientific purposes.
If you want to find out what the effects of space have on a tubby podcaster, I am a perfect subject for that.
I hear zero gravity restores hair growth.
Oh, don't tease me, Joe. That's a dragon I've been chasing a long time.
Ouch. Ooh, just got real in here, you guys.
Nah,
okay.
I'm fine with being bald. It's beautiful, y'all. No, but
you
seriously.
You make it work, dude.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But no, Richard Garriott is a great example of that. Truly an evangelist for space travel, and that, while there aren't any hard and fast figures that are absolutely verifiable, there are a lot of estimates that are out there that suggest that the work he did, and he talks about, you know, the fact that he did perform scientific experiments while aboard the ISS, may have offset his ticket price by a significant amount of money. Now, granted, we're still talking about, you know, a potential $30 million price tag and a $6 or $7 million reduction in that because of the work he did. But that's still kind of a proof of concept.
Oh, sure.
Now, if you were able to perhaps have a private company that created a program where people could apply to be the next pioneer, you know, the next private astronaut, and they're going to be continuing on some sort of scientific research in the process, maybe that would bring things within the range of more people. Perhaps not your average traveler, but at least lower that ceiling a bit.
Right. So Richard Garriott was able to offset part of his costs with scientific research. But the thing about him is he's not like a PhD scientific researcher. Is it like a professional?
Yeah, I mean, he was a computer games programmer.
Right.
I mean, a smart dude, granted.
Super smart. But, uh-huh. Yeah, but not a scientist.
Not to knock him at all. I just mean that that's an example.
Not an astrophysicist.
Right. That I think that your average person with the right amount of training, I'm sure could be authorized to do useful research in space,
sure,
especially if they document everything in a way that makes sure, okay, we can rule out errors.
And right. I agree that I still think that if you are secretive enough when you're the corporation and the real experiment is finding out what happens to the person, you know, you can give them any busy work and it's fine.
I think that would be really cool. In fact, for some people, it might even enhance the experience.
Sure.
If I were going to go to space,
I would love
to be able to do research in space. I mean, I don't know if we talked about, did we mention earlier how much of a premium there is on zero-G space?
We
kind of alluded to it, but we didn't really go into it. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of industries that are looking at using zero-G environments to do all sorts of testing, everything from medical testing to designing various prototypes, just about anything you can imagine, all these different industries. It's an invaluable resource, and it's the most limited resource we have right now, because you have one option, really, which is to go and work on the ISS, and that is an incredibly short list of people that are allowed to do that.
And aside from science, this could be a really worthwhile venture. Coming back to money, actually, this could make economic sense in the long run, if we work out exactly how to do it. Back in 1995, NASA and the Space Transportation Association put together a whole report on what they thought about this potentially future burgeoning space tourism industry. And they pointed out that travel and tourism are one of the world's largest businesses. Gross revenues in the U.S. alone exceed like $400 billion per year. So not too shabby. And if you can expand that beyond the, you know, into the limitless reaches of space, then this could make us some money. The scope of the project, you know, would have to be worthwhile in order to kind of cash into that. There was another really good report done in the mid-90s by the Japanese Rocket Society that looked at all of the costs and development of this kind of program and what exactly it would take to make it profitable. And they estimated that to be financially feasible, a space tourism program would need over 50 vehicles and would need to embark on tens of flights every day. Although tens of flights to space is still a lot of, I mean, you know, it sounds ridiculously low, especially when you consider that commercial flights do some, you know, 3 million passengers per day.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, flying to Duluth is a little different than flying to the moon.
It is. But once you, they were saying.
Well, but once you get there, it's about the same.
Oh, well, and either way, you know, the relative merits of Duluth aside, people aren't going to be spending these millions of dollars on a trip to Duluth anytime soon. But if you could get that number down to something slightly more reasonable, something like $20,000 per flight, this report from the Japanese Rocket Society was saying that at that cost, they were looking at generating over $10 billion per year from this sort of industry.
Yeah. So it could... It could, in theory, it almost becomes a chicken and the egg thing, right?
Oh,
because you're like, how do you get up the money so that you can end up creating the business that will then allow
create
you to
the money.
Yeah, create the money so that you can continue to grow the business. I mean, we're talking about a brand new industry that's growing on something that has been established but not put to the purpose of tourism. I still remain optimistic. I think that we are going to see successful space tourism industries. I hope that we see it soon. Like, even if we're talking just suborbital, just suborbital seems so dismissive, it's still an incredible achievement.
Oh, sure.
But assuming that we can see some real success in the coming year, and next couple of years, I'm really hopeful that this actually does become a real industry. I would love to be able to go up into space and have that experience. That would be phenomenal.
And these initial reports were talking about this kind of thing being feasible by about 2020, and that was back in the mid-90s. So I think that was, considering the state of the industry at the time, that was a pretty ambitious estimate.
Yeah, sure.
However, we've made such wonderful advances in the past 10 years that...
I wonder if it's still a 30-year rollout, though. I mean, we do have those rolling rollouts, right? The whole, in 30 years it'll happen, in 20 years it'll happen.
We do. But I think that some of the numbers that the companies that are looking into this have stated have been similar.
And it's clear that people like Richard Branson, people like Jeff Bezos, people like Elon Musk are very serious about this. They have made huge strides toward it. It's not like they came up with a crazy plan, did a little bit of work, and then said, yo, this is way too hard. No, they've stuck with it. I mean, Virgin Galactic's a great example in that that was something they were hoping they would have their first flight, suborbital flight in 2007. Didn't happen. They're still working on it, but they, in 2014, early 2014, they've already had another test flight. They're determined to make this work. So that gives me a lot of hope as well, because I know that when people put their minds to something, it's pretty much impossible to stop them from doing it eventually, right? I mean, if they're determined to do it, it's going to happen, unless the very laws of physics themselves deny it.
And even then, Elon Musk is pretty much like,
get a sonic screwdriver in there and you're good to go. So, while I know that we've talked a lot about the barriers and the obstacles that are in the way, remember that in forward thinking, we always like to acknowledge the fact that there are barriers and obstacles, but we don't let that discourage us, right? That's just something else that we take into account when we start to think about the future. And it's not, this is what's going to prevent the future from happening. It's, this is something we need to remember when we're working toward that future.
Right.
So, I'm really excited to see where this goes in the next few years. And I really do hope that sometime in my life, I'm able to take advantage of this. It may mean that I'm going to have to sell a limb, but I'm going to figure it out. It's going to happen.
That'll actually make you cheaper to take into space.
I'll weigh less. Yeah. I'll weigh less.
Good
thinking. So that's a good way to lose 10 pounds really quickly. All right. So, guys, if you've enjoyed this, make sure you go to our website, fwthinking.com. That's where we have all the videos. We have the blog posts. We have the podcast episodes. We've got lots of content there. It's really awesome. You should go check that out. Also, remember you can follow us and interact with us on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+ with FWThinking. We're at all of those. Come and be part of this conversation. Tell us what you're excited about in the future. Maybe we'll even be able to do an episode about it. We're really excited with the exchanges we've had with our audience. It's been fantastic. So keep up the good work, guys. You guys are an inspiration to us, and we hope we can help inspire you guys. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.